immensely enjoy talking to everybody again, seeing old friends again, and also getting to know new faces and new ideas. So this is great. And I would like to talk about quantum criticality of Dirac fermions, two-dimensional or into space dimensions, and what we have learned from field theory, different field theoretical methods in the last years, particular with a focus on critical exponents when we go beyond the leading order. So when we really take this as serious as we can do and try to extract quantitative exponents. So what I would like to do today is I would like to start with sort of a very single-minded mini review of Dirac criticality and what we can learn from field theory. So I have already seen in the last 2 days and also over a discussion over breakfast that I don't need to add a lot of motivation because a lot of people seem to be already quite motivated. That's, of course, very nice to see. So I will just briefly justify the use of Gros-Neveu models in that particular context and then focus very much on what we did in order to extract critical exponents. Specifically, what our main contribution was here is to do a perturbative renormalization group calculation up to four loop order, where we were heavily preying on technical developments that have been done in a different community, namely the community of high energy physics or particle physics. The reason being that eventually we're dealing now with a relativistic quantum field theory, and the particle physicists, they have one very one relativistic quantum field theory that they really like and really like to understand, which is of course the standard model of particle physics. So they have spent decades to develop very sophisticated methods, and we came with this question of quantum criticality for these particular systems, and they were just basically right away applicable to that particular situation. And then, of course, we can calculate this. These are the facts, and then we have to extract numbers, and I would like to discuss with you a little bit what we can really expect from these results in terms of precision and how reliable they are, and in particular also when they are not reliable and how to see that, and I think that's quite important in comparison to other quantum many-body methods. So there are a lot of experts on sophisticated lattice numerical quantum Monte Carlo methods in the audience, and we like to compare, and eventually we would like to settle the question of critical exponents, for example, for these universality classes, so we have to see what we can really learn from each of the methods, and so I would like to discuss the field theoretical aspect, of course. If there's some time left, which I doubt a little bit, but still, I have to say that the first part of the results will be not super up, they will be up to date, but they will be not super new. I've talked about this before, and you might have even seen me before talking about that. So in the light of new developments from conformal bootstrap and quantum Monte Carlo, I just want to reassess the results that we had and see how seriously we should take them. But I've also prepared something that is a little bit more recent, so if I have the time, I will also talk about that. If I don't have the time, it's not bad, because we'll have a talk tomorrow by Lukas Janssen, who will talk about that particular subject in more detail anyway, so we'll see how that works out. The results that we achieved within this field theoretical perspective would not have been possible without different configurations of collaborations. And of course, you know Igor and Lukas, who are both in the audience. But there are also, I would like to specifically mention the guys that have been involved in the technical developments behind this, because this is really a field where you need a tremendous amount of expertise to really be able to do this in the first place. So people, I've listed everybody in alphabetical order, so there's no priority induced here. Or implied here. So John Gracie from Liverpool is one of the people who was heavily involved in that, and we have worked with Peter Marquardt and Nikolai Zerf from Berlin, and also with Luminica Mihaila, who was formerly in Heidelberg, and we had also the help of some heroic students, Daniel Kuti and Bernhard Irik from Cologne, and Georgia Rai, who is a Lukas PhD student in Dresden. All right, so let me get started. Now, we have learned in the last like 15 years that non-relativistic materials can give rise to quasi-relativistic particles that are Dirac, Weyl, or Majorana quasi-particle excitations. And this is something that we understand fairly well how this can happen, but I still find it this phenomenon rather fascinating because it draws this very nice connection between condensed matter and particle physics. So now if you take these Dirac fermions and you appreciate that they can be interacting, you can learn that there might be some phase transitions between this Dirac fermionic phase or some ordered phase of Dirac fermions, in particular when you take into account these interactions that are strong enough. And if that phase transition turns out to be a second order, then the two phases are separated by a quantum critical point, of course. Most prominent example that has been probably discussed at the largest length in the literature is graphene, which can undergo antiferromagnetic or Kekulé bond or different charge ordering transitions if the interactions are just strong enough. There are also different materials examples like surface states of topological insulators, D-wave superconductors, and as Lucas will tell you, frustrated magnets where Dirac particles can emerge and interact. So the general picture from a, let's say, universal perspective that emerges is that you would have two different phases separated by a quantum critical point where the one phase would be the Dirac semi-metal with the beautiful Dirac cones and some ordered phase with an order parameter that we would not know a priori, can be different ones. But what generally happens is that it gaps out the Dirac fermions by a mass, and you can tune across this transition by using a tuning parameter, which could be an interaction strength, for example. We are considering zero temperature here, of course, because this is a workshop on quantum criticality. And then the obvious question and the very simple question that I would like to ask is, okay, this is a quantum critical point with gapless fermionic fluctuations. What are the critical exponents of this particular phase transition? And if we come up with a number, how serious can we take this number or how quantitative are we here? And okay, if I'm asking about quantitative results, let me just remind you of what we think is quantitative when we talk about critical exponents that we cannot exactly write down in some exactly solvable model. So let me just briefly remind you about how amazing the results on the three-dimensional Ising universality classes are when you look at, for example, the correlation length exponent, which is defined by the exponent in this power law, looking at the correlation length divergence at the critical temperature, or the order parameter correlation function right at the critical temperature, which is this, characterized by this anomalous dimension. So these two numbers have been calculated with a selection of methods for many decades now, and they had been fairly well converged already for decades, but there are still new developments are going on, and just like about 10 years ago, or in the course of the last decade, there was this conformal bootstrap suddenly popping up, which managed to calculate the critical exponents of this universality class with unprecedented precision. So I think that's the best number that I found. It's already a little bit older, but I think that's what the current state of the art is. Then you have quantum Monte Carlo, which is also fairly precise. You have the perturbative RG. This is the method that I will discuss today with you, which is not as precise as the other two, but it's still in the same, I would say, ballpark. You have alternative RG approaches, which are non-perturbative. And of course, you have also experiment, and also experiment fits right into the picture. So I think the amazing thing that you see here is basically that these numbers within the error bars given, they really agree. And not only like the first number, or it goes up to the second number, I would say, more or less. So what this is here is now it's the textbook example for criticality that is not exactly solvable. So you can open, for example, Peskin-Schröder, a generally appreciated quantum field theory book. You look at the section of critical phenomena, you find a table like that with a comparison of different methods, of course. So this is beautiful. And also, it's a prime benchmark for the development of many-body methods. So if somebody comes up with a new many-body method, I think a very generic question is, what does it give in terms of critical exponents for the Ising model? And if you're failing to give decent critical exponents, then of course people will ask you whether you have a good method or not. Well, so that's this point here. So critical exponents are a driving force for the development of many-body methods. And now we have to appreciate that Dirac fermions, especially when they're gapless Dirac fermions, they are not in these universality classes, which we understand well. Instead, as was shown by Igor a couple of years back, the critical point of, let's say, a generic Dirac system at quantum criticality can be described by a fairly simple continuum field theory. And if we are thinking of graphene in the back of our minds or these systems in two spatial dimensions, it would be a field theory in 2+1 dimensions. We're talking about Euclidean dimensions here. Yeah. It's just to distinguish the spatial and the temporal directions. And that model is called the Gros-Neveu model, which was, of course, discussed already many years before. So it's a very simple, innocent-looking quantum field theory, which is special in the sense that it's basically the simplest fermionic theory which features a critical point. It's simple because it has a lot of symmetries. It's relativistic. It does not have the complication of an extended Fermi surface that is typically not of a very advantageous nature when we want to do things in solid-state physics. And so if you take a certain amount of spinner components, in that case it would be 8 spinner components, this model would describe the charge density wave order transition of electrons, so spinful electrons in graphene. Now there's a bosonized version of the model that you can get if you just introduce a Hubbard-Stronowich field, a real scalar single component field. And this bosonized version basically looks like that. It comes with the Dirac fermion kinetic term. It comes with the Yukawa coupling. You have a dynamic term for the order parameter field, and you have an order parameter self-interaction, basically. And the amazing thing now is that both of these models, they are obviously very closely related, and they are even more related than you would expect in the first place. They do both feature a critical point between 2 and 4 dimensions, and the critical point that you can calculate in either of those models is in the same universality class. And we will explicitly use that when we try to extract good critical exponents from field theory. And I will in the following refer to this as the chiral universality class, which is, I think, a good name because on the one hand, it's basically composed out of a sector of chiral fermions and then an easing field theory by virtue of the real order parameter. But at the same time, to make a little bit of propaganda, it's sort of the easing model for fermions because it's the simplest relevant model that you can just write down. So it's really like a fermionic version of the easing model. And that brings me back to the question, how well do we understand the critical exponents in that model? And there have been a lot of developments, especially in the last 10 years or so, that went towards a precision determination of the universality of these fermions. First, I would like to mention these Monte Carlo methods, which have managed to find basically microscopic lattice models, which have second order phase transitions that are in the Gros-Neveu universality class, or where we have very strong hints that they are in the Gros-Neveu universality class, and where you can really find sign problem-free formulations. I think one of the first works in that direction was from Scheilich, and then different flavors of Monte Carlo calculations have been developed and compared, and the development is going on. So this is just a random selection of works, so I hope I did not offend anybody by forgetting them. You can let me know after the talk. Then the second approach, which was very successful in the determination of critical exponents, was the conformal bootstrap, which popped up with unprecedented precision for the ON models and has since then also been extended to fermionic systems, not with the same precision yet. But I know that the protagonists of that approach are working on that, and they are coming up with new numbers soon. I will. I don't have the numbers, but I have some information about from private communication. We can discuss this later. So, and then of course the more traditional approaches in terms of critical phenomena are renormalization group approaches, which are in a sense not in some sense not competitive with these two methods because they can somehow come up with more precision, but at the same time it gives a very good understanding of what's going on in critical phenomena in the first place. And you have already also seen that in the easing universality class, also the renormalization group approach do a very good job in estimating critical exponents when you go to high enough order. And so there are also non-perturbative approaches, but today I would like to discuss these higher loop calculations that are adapted from high energy physics. So just briefly, but how am I doing with time, by the way? Okay. So just briefly, let me go through the individual steps of at least conceptually what we are doing when we want to set up, when we want to calculate critical exponents with field theory. So what we do, we start with a Lagrangian that we had, and we equip each of the single terms with a renormalization group, a constant, which are the z's here, and the z's are considered as scale-dependent parameters, saying that the scale is the energy scale mu, which parameterizes the RG flow, and then by variation of the RG flow, RG scale, we generate the flow, and if we translate these wave function normalizations into beta functions for the couplings, we get two in that particular case because we have the four boson coupling and the Yukawa coupling, we get two beta functions, and critical behavior is basically corresponds to a scale invariant system, meaning that we would look for zeros of these beta functions, which are the fixed points, and that particular system, we generically find four of them, blue, red, green, and the one that I omitted here, which is just the Gaussian fixed point. And so, we'll have to find the stable one of those, so the one where the flow lines just go in, which is automatically approached as you integrate out your fluctuations, and the vicinity of this fixed point then describes your critical exponents. So everything that you have to do is you have to determine these z factors, and that's what you can do by expanding in loops. If you want to do a perturbative expansion, for example. So you take these tree-level diagrams that you can introduce from considering the Lagrangian, and then first thing you do, of course, is considering the one-loop correction, so all the diagrams that you can construct basically from these fundamental tree-level vertices and lines, and this is something that you can still calculate by hand, basically. Something you can do. But we want to go beyond that, for example, just to exhibit briefly how difficult this comes when you go beyond one loop. You can just topologically write all these things down, also by hand, basically. But this is a selection of the two-loop diagrams, and there are 96 more. If you go to three-loop order, then you get more complicated-looking diagrams implying more complicated integrations, and you get 1,700 more. And if you go to four-loop order, you get in total over 30,000 diagrams. So this is a typical task for a computer, of course, and this is where we got the help from our friends of high energy physics. They have developed a systematic way of doing these calculations by first generating all the diagrams, then doing regularizations and declaring Feynman rules, reducing all the complicated integrals to a certain set of integrals that are known, eventually, and that you can then evaluate analytically, or at least find analytical representations for the numerical integrals that you get. And this is just to say that sort of for these relativistic quantum field theories, this is a standard recipe that is under control. So this gives us facts in a way, but then we still have to see what we do with these facts. If we do this for the charge density wave transition in graphene, which would be the case of two flavors of four-component Dirac fermions. So this will be important for the following discussion for a reason that I will explain in a second. And evaluate everything in 4 minus epsilon dimensions. We get the famous epsilon expansion of the critical exponents, which are inverse correlation length exponent, boson anomalous dimension, and fermion anomalous dimension. And then you get these series. Of course, these numbers don't tell you anything. This is just a little bit to show off that we get numerical results. But what you're really interested in are numerical estimates. So let me show you how I think that I can get reasonable numerical estimates. So you can break it down just by evaluating this. You see that you have the series, which is not clearly converging or getting smaller coefficients, but which is not obviously totally outrageous either. Then let me now exploit one thing that I mentioned in the beginning, because we can do this in 4 minus epsilon expansions for the Kostin-Vilyukava model, but we can also do this for, not we, John Gracie and his collaborators can do this, and they have. We can also use the Gross-Neveu model in 2 plus epsilon dimensions. And now I have said that those two are in the same universality class, so I can bring together both expansions from both limits and get more reliable results if I do systematic interpolations between those two limits. I will not show you the numerical numbers. Instead, I've decided just to show you the results of these interpolations. So we're interpolating between 2 and 4 dimensions, coming from 4 dimensions with this expansion, coming from 2 dimensions with the expansion from the Gross-Neveu model. And what I show you here are polynomial interpolations. That means we choose polynomials that in the vicinity of 2 dimensions reproduce exactly the exponents of these, doing a normal Taylor expansion around this one point. And in the vicinity of this, of 4 dimensions, it exactly reproduces this expansion. So it's asymptotically correct in both of these limits and interpolates systematically between those two. And what you see here, I think this is the best one to look at because you see the distinction between the lines most clearly. The fermion anomalous dimension comes from 0, goes back to 0, and at some point it pops up. Yeah, and 3 dimensions is the one that we're interested in. And from faint to darker goes higher in loop order. So this is interpolation between 1 loop order and 1 loop order, 2 loop order, 3 loop order, 4 loop order. And it seems to, I mean, it's not obviously converged, but it seems the distances grow smaller. And yeah, it's even more more well behaved in these cases. This is why you can't see the difference really, really well. So this is one way we could do it, but you could also say, let's just use two-sided Padé approximants and just add this to the game. You can do this also by making sure that the Padé approximants expand into the corresponding series in the respective limits. You also see that there's at least an apparent convergence going on, and from this we can get a table. Yeah? So these gray lines are our interpolations and Padé resummations, and then we have added some numbers for that particular universality class, reminding that it's 2 flavors, 4 component fermions. That we could find. So what do we see here? This is our best estimate from this method, and you can see that there are also some large n calculations which go to higher order, to order 2, n squared in these 2 exponents, and to n to the power of 3 in this one. And then now it's getting exciting, right? This is what the conformal bootstrap finds. They have measured this one and this one, and this looks really good. Yeah, surprisingly good, I would even say. And if you look at the correlation length exponent, there is a 10% discrepancy. And I would like to discuss the possible origin of that one in the conclusions, or in I think in the next slide, actually. Functional RG is also interesting. That's something, it's just my favorite RG method, but I don't think in that case it's yet competitive with what we did before. It's just a little bit to show that there's a different approach to this, even from RG, but I would not, yeah. Let's just not discuss this right now. Instead, let's look at something different. Let's look at the Monte Carlo estimates. I mentioned that Shailesh has put something out in 2013, which is supposedly in that universality class. So the numbers are quite different from ours, but there has been some development since then, of course, also. And I find this very encouraging because I think there's something to do here. Also, there's some work from Ziyang from about 2 years ago, which is with a different Monte Carlo approach with one of his designer Hamiltonians, and it looks like this is more approaching the values that we find here within the field theory. So. Okay, so what can we say about that? Let me make, this is now a little bit of an opinion, but it's an informed opinion, but we can, I think I would like to discuss this with you, basically. So, yes, of course.
The way you are doing the calculation of epsilon expansion.
Yeah.
The number of flavors is a free
parameter. I can vary the number of flavors, yes.
How does, say, if we look at the area.
Yeah. I'm happy you asked that because it's on the next slide. Okay, so let me come back to this when the next slide is. Let me just discuss this in a second. Just to wrap up what we found here, so there's a very good agreement of the perturbative approaches with the conformal bootstrap for the anomalous dimensions and with large N2. And that is encouraging because this is really, I mean, if you find the agreement between perturbative RG and large N, it might be not so surprising. It's both perturbative approaches and N is not super small, so it might work automatically. So that might fool you into thinking that this is more precise than it actually is. Yeah? But the fact that the conformal bootstrap in the numbers that they really measure agrees very well, that is something that I find quite surprising and encouraging, really. About this, I have to say that within the conformal bootstrap, this is a derivative object. So they have somehow extracted that number from an additional procedure. And if I talk to them, they say to me, this is the one that they are not so sure about. And they showed me newer numbers, an update which is not yet published, unfortunately. But it looks that their new estimate is really, really close to one. So that seems to work really well. That's my latest information. So I can't vouch for that, but that's what I've been told. I think looking at that particular example, I would like to make the statement that this particular model with NF equals 2, four-component fermions with an easing order parameter is, I think, the best chance to settle the critical behavior across different methods, including quantum Monte Carlo, soon. And I'm emphasizing that because if we manage to settle that, we can put it next to the table of the easing model in the textbooks. It would be a great example of a success of as a result of a community effort in this quantum many-body methods. We'll have to wait, of course, for what the conformal bootstrappers say about that. So
can I just ask this,
yes?
Two flavors, four components.
Yes, so eight-component spinners, yeah. And I will explain you now why I think that very specific statement is, I would like to explain why I make this very specific statement. The reason is that if you can look this as you asked, as a number of the flavors, here the N has a little bit of different meaning. It's just the N here is the number of spinner components altogether. So we have been looking at 2, 4 components, which would be 8 spinner components altogether. This was the result that we just discussed. And then you can ask, okay, how does it work out for large N? So as you approach large N, and you see, so the gray area are random Padé approximations for the 4 minus epsilon, not including the 2 plus epsilon. And you see as you go to larger n, this seems to converge rather nicely. So it seems to be well-behaved, as you would expect, because it's under perturbative control at some point. But then you could ask, okay, let's go to a little bit smaller n, because I have also seen that quantum Monte Carlo likes the single 4-component thing. I don't exactly understand why, but it's probably more straightforward to implement for some reason. Why didn't I tell you about that one? And the reason is within field theory, it's sort of a bad thing within field theory, not a bad thing, it's somehow generic, but if I look at the critical exponents from the 2 plus epsilon expansion, for well-understood analytic reasons, they exhibit a pole at NF equals 1/2, which would be a 2-component fermion. Yeah? That's because the vertex doesn't renormalize there. And that fact that the critical exponents have this pole already shows up at N equals 4 when I do interpolations. So the pole basically deforms my estimates for the critical exponents, and you can already see that at NF equals 1. And if, for example, I make these interpolations, that's, for example, this solid gray line, I see that there's this pole at N equals 2 also here. And you see that the estimate from the interpolation just follows this pole, of course, which makes the results not as good anymore. So message is that results from two-sided interpolations are not as good for NF equals 1 as they are at NF equals 2. Huh? That's why I say that NF equals 2 seems to be a sweet spot for the comparison of different methods, because you can do everything. You can do Monte Carlo, you can do conformal bootstrap, and you can do a reasonable interpolation of the field theoretical results. 5 minutes, okay, I will manage to do that. Okay, if you have a two-component fermion, you want to write down a local term that technically... to be honest, I have to look it up. But there, I just remember there's a very good analytical, well-understood reasoning why for these two-component fermions in two dimensions you don't get the renormalization of the four fermion term. Maybe.
Because the bosonized theory in two dimensions, it's like 1 plus 1 quantum theory, and the bosonized version is kind of free theory or something like that. It's something kind of one to
tell you. Yeah, as I said, I don't remember it exactly anymore, but I know where to look. Sorry.
It's spinless integer into 1 plus 1.
Yeah.
So
okay, yeah. That's probably correct. So, all right, so let me, and f equals 2 seems to be a sweet spot, but then you can ask, okay, well, you have done these for loop calculations. Let's stick at nf equals 2, but let's take a different order parameter and see how that works out. And we did that in the field theory, but this is important. It's an important question because I think the most straightforward thing to do, at least from a model point of view, would be just to take honeycomb fermions and let them interact locally, like with a Hubbard interaction. Then you get an antiferromagnetic transition, which is a different order parameter. So you can cast that into the language of a universal field theory, which would be this so-called chiral Heisenberg model, where you have this three-component order parameter going on, and we did the for-loop order calculation at 4 minus epsilon dimensions, and what you see is this. That's just what you get. You cannot discuss this away. So it's you get this the series for the inverse correlation length exponent, which at first seems to have smaller and smaller coefficients, but then they already rise again. So after all, it's an asymptotic series, so you never know what you get. But this is 2, so this. How do I get a reasonable number from this? I don't know. Then the second, if you look at the order parameter anomalous dimension, you see that all these contributions just add up. Ideally, you would get an alternating series where you can make a reasonable Padé approximation or something, but this doesn't work like that. That seems to work a little bit better, but I mean, if the others don't work, I don't really know what to make of this. So. I would just conclude from that. I can calculate it, I can give you a result, but the perturbative series behaves rather badly, and there's nothing I can do about that right now. So I cannot just improve that. I could even go to five loop. I cannot, but even if you go to five loop order, you would not safely know that that would improve. That's a bit of a bummer because there are impressive quantum Monte Carlo results on that. They are also not fully converged as far as I know, but there's something you could do about it. Also, yet there are no results on 2 plus epsilon. I have learned at the conference that this is about to change, but so from this and this, you couldn't even make an interpolation right now, and there's no data from conformal bootstrap. Yeah, and that brings me back to my statement. That brings me to the last type of models, which I will just skip in the interest of time. It will be explained to you by Lucas. We have also, because it's still fun to play around, even if you don't know what you get, and you can do all these calculations, large N epsilon expansion, and see what you get and compare it, blah, blah, blah. And so let me just wrap up and conclude. My conclusion is, and this is maybe not a surprise after all, because it's perturbative series, even at high loop order, there's no guarantee that you get quantitative results. Yeah? What is maybe more of a surprise, it sometimes it does seem to work, at least. As I tried to argue in the case of the chiral easing model at nf equals 2, which I said could be a sweet spot for comparison of different methods. And my question to the audience would be, what do you think in terms of can we expect an update on quantum Monte Carlo? How do you estimate the chances of settling this question if you really, I mean, if you would have just spare computing time? And is there a good chance to do this in the near future? Then I didn't mention one very important method, so this is more like a speculative fun fact. Experiment, of course, is still missing on these universality classes. Just as a pure speculation, we have seen correlated states in twisted bilayer graphene, which also features a Dirac cone at charge neutrality for symmetry reasons, and we can also see here, so this is the longitudinal resistivity, which should not be, it should not be an insulator here. So expectation is that this, there might be some semi-metal insulator transition going on here. Maybe we have a chance to do something about it and get an experiment. But this is, yeah, I cannot judge on that, but it's an interesting perspective at least. I have argued that the chiral Heisenberg model, so the antiferromagnetic transition on the honeycomb, is maybe not the best point to compare because we cannot do anything from field theory above, on top of what we already did, and we see that it seems not to work so well. And also, there's no conformal bootstrap data yet. I did not talk at all about gauge fields, but just if you happen to become interested in gauge fields and for loop calculations, you might as well check out that paper where we had another look at the Abelian-Higgs model, or if you come from a different community, might be, you might call it scalar QED3, which features a critical number of boson flavors, which we could also expand in epsilon to the power of 3 in that case. It's a for loop calculation, but yeah. And well, I think that's a good point to stop. What's my?
What's a global
temperature? Ah, yeah, yeah. I was expecting that question to say. You're asking basically about how the fermions transform under which symmetry, whether they are 0,8 Majorana fermions or a certain flavor of SU2 fermions, or is that basically the question?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we have NF equals 2 4 component fermions that would bring it to SU4, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so then I'm pretty sure that the whole bootstrap was done differently from that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's because the conformal bootstrap is likely inspired by the true 2 plus 1 dimensional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I can say something about that, yes.
Yeah.
So,
and the related question is how do you tell the difference between chiral isomorphism from the 0,8 or 0,2 and 4.5 in your epsilon? From 4D, there is no difference.
Yeah. Okay, the second question I will have to ask you again. Let me just say something about the first question. We have different regularization schemes that we explored first of all, if you do the calculation for the 0,8 and the SU4, the difference in the loop expansion only shows up at 4 loop order. Up to 3 loop order, at least the beta functions for the leading exponents or the leading exponents will be identical, order by order, up to 3 loop order. At 4 loop order, there's a difference that shows up in diagrams that involve 5 internal fermion lines. And that is because, of course, even dimensional and odd dimensional representations of the Clifford algebra behave differently. But we can repair this by using a specific regularization scheme, which takes into account the missing diagrams. And we have a general expression at 4 loop order which does the one or the other implementation, and I can calculate results in terms of numbers. And I can see that the results from these additional diagrams only show up after 5 digits. So no number that I've given you is sensitive to the difference between those two symmetries for the exponents that I've looked at. Of course, this might be different for different operators, but for these leading exponents, the results don't show up in our, the differences don't show up in our results. The second question, I think I didn't fully understand it, that you had.
You get 2 questions.
Yeah.
I think what
he
answered is my
step. Okay.
I was asking how do you distinguish
them? Ah, okay, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't say it's entirely different. It's generically it's generic that it's probably quite close.
Might be close, but still they have different universes. They have different sections. Right?
Yeah.
But
do you know if they can also do the other symmetry? I mean, is it somehow carved into stone that they use that one? Yeah, I'd be happy to learn more about that from you. So it's interesting.
Yeah, you should also make sure that the symmetry are the same.
Yes.
Yeah. I think there is a question.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, please go ahead. Maybe you can say because I don't have the
microphone. The question in the the virtual question, please. Ziyang, hi.
Yeah. So Michael, so very nice talk. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. We all
can. Good. So. Very good. So I always feel a bit, a little bit embarrassed, but more excited by you to put on request for more Monte Carlo. So we can, for the icing, I think we can even do a better job than what we did before for the two flavor and Cairo icing. My question is, you mentioned that for the two flavor, NF equals to 2, Heisenberg is not converging, but for the NF equals 2 XY or O2, mm-hmm. What is the situation there?
I have to get this from the top of my head. I don't remember it exactly anymore, but the XY model is much better behaved than the Heisenberg model. I think tentatively mm-hmm. It goes as the order parameter symmetry gets more, as the order parameter gets more component, it's less well behaved. The reason why I didn't show the XY is that also there I don't have the 2 plus epsilon, which helps me to interpolate. So I can probably give you a reasonable estimate on the XY if this is of particular interest to you, but it's I wouldn't think it's as good as what we can do in the easing model, of course. That's the reason. And also, I really didn't want to embarrass. Also, I put your results up because I think they are the best that are currently available, and they are cool. I mean, it's really showing that it's going into the right direction. So it's, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I think we could do a better job. I mean, even with a better model. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Just to add to the discussion here, the exponents that you showed from mm-hmm. That comes from a staggered fermion calculation on a space-time lattice. Mm-hmm. Again, it goes back to the question of what symmetries the lattice preserves and what is the transition we are studying. Mm-hmm. I am sort of skeptical that maybe the universality class that you are studying is not the universality class. Mm. We are able to grow on the lattice, right? The right approach, at least from my understanding, would be to write down all sort of operators and study the RG flow in the space, and then ask what is the parameter we're tuning, and then ask which is the sort of the critical point we are exploring. So I think the reason I bring that up is compared to Hamiltonian fermions, the space-time lattice fermions have even less symmetry. Mm-hmm. So the symmetry breaking pattern, which we have preserved, is some, I agree, it's a Z2 chiral symmetry, but it's embedded in some other strange, I think, flavor group, right? Mm-hmm. So I worry that maybe it's another axis.
Yeah.
Is that a possibility?
In principle, yes. I mean, I of course, appreciate these comments. Also yours before. I mean, but this is being extremely critical about how different these universality class possibly are. But from the point of view of our field theoretical approach, when I look at the leading exponents, I don't have hints that the exponents are so extremely different. So it would still be surprising. You're absolutely right. We don't know anything about it, but it would still be a little bit surprising, I would say.
So maybe it is a good time for the two communities to come together, analyze one lattice model, figure out all the relevant operators that needs to be put in, and then
yes.
the two
I think that would be great, yes. Yeah. So then my question would... So you would say it's straightforward to settle this, or? The better, yeah.
So kind of related question, maybe to you and to Tradition, and also to Evan, actually. So you have this Hamiltonian approach, right?
Yes.
And Evan mentioned does that better compare with the field theory, or does it have lower current dimensions?
If I understand right there, the number of possibilities are just too. There will be two possibilities, and I think we've gotten the right one, but it's good to sort of make sure with the experts that that is the right one. I think there was some discussion, I guess, at very little.
I think maybe it'd be a good idea for the moderator to stop.
Yeah, maybe we can discuss this.
I mean, I put the numbers up that I found. And I think a little bit there, if NF equals 1 would work equally well for us, I would have found much more things to compare from the quantum Monte Carlo side. But this NF equals 2 case is something that has not been followed so much, because if you look at the Hubbard model, generically for fermions, you would need a nearest neighbor repulsive interaction to induce that transition. But if this, I think in generic quantum Monte Carlo approaches, if this is larger than a third of the local interaction, then you get a sign problem. But you would need that in order to get the right order. So that's probably why this has not been investigated at the same, with the same, let's say, as much. Yeah.
Formal continuum limit of staggered fermions is not the right fermions in general. It can be so in the case of, say, isotopically free gauge theories.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be very careful. If you have to start with a couple of exploits, it's actually unclear that the correct continuum limit is in fact the right fermions.
So
I'll say a little bit more on Friday, but I think the formal continuum limit is actually what's called a Taylor Dirac fermion.
Okay.
So you have to be careful.
Maybe I can have two questions back. One is, could you do Grosnevieux universality on the lattice? Could you do Dirac fermions on the lattice with Grosnevieux universality class? Could you do that? What I write down as a field theory?
Yeah. It's not necessarily decomposable in terms of continuum Dirac.
You suspect that it may
suspect it's not.
My second question is, you're basically implying that I shouldn't compare to the numbers that I found, right?
Just be careful, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Really, just really everyone should try to say the staggered photons on the space-time lattice may not be the same.
Okay, yeah. I think that's the right audience to discuss this anyway, because you of course know. Yeah. Mu being, yes, right at the Dirac point where,
So I know in the Monte Carlo there's a sign problem, but your method, can you make it a finite chemical potential? Because you want to remain at the Dirac point, you can't have.
I mean, the universal field theory is somehow designed around that point to be valid, but I think there are field theoretical approaches where you can expand into. Onto both sides, where you can really investigate the field theory at finite chemical potential in the symmetric phase or in the symmetry broken phase. Or if you want to write it down in terms of a lattice Hubbard model, there are also some field theoretical approaches which allow me to detect, for example, phase diagrams or instabilities. But these are not, these don't work on the same level of precision, I would say. Yeah.
But from the universality viewpoint, it's been known for a while that just using the symmetry of the staggered operator, it falls in what we refer to as the symplectic ensemble as opposed to unitary ensemble. So it's not clear how the last I mean, if you just look at random metric theory, they're completely different. Yet, we know that staggered fermions do give correct results in the continuum. Unclear how it works. There is an issue. But Langley, you can come to the results that
Who's that? Andreas Wipf?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I think they have put forward some hybrid Monte Carlo approach, which also, there are also estimates from that, which I did not put up. So this is one of the numbers that I did not show. Yeah. But, I mean, would you generally agree, if I would be able to improve on the Heisenberg universality, chiral Heisenberg universality class, this would be something that we could compare with each other right away, couldn't we? Because when you write this down on the letter, on a honeycomb lattice, this is what you want to do. This is where the field theory basically comes from, right? Or is there some subtle reason why this wouldn't work? Or why you would at least put this up for discussion? Or maybe that's something for...
Many minutes left for the coffee break, so I suggest it starts maybe 5 minutes later.
There's just a break anyway.
Yeah. Yes, but there was only a 15-minute break left. So
May I make a comment?
Yes, please go ahead. Yes.
Thank you. I've been dipping in and out. It's not been as audible as it could be. But I understand there's been some discussion about the use of staggered fermions for looking at the Grossnever or Grossnever-Yukawa universality class. It is possible also to use domain wall fermions. That problem was originally studied by Kogut and Vranas several years ago, and I've also looked at it. It can be done, but it's a shame I'm not there to discuss more, because it's not been done seriously yet with the precision which this kind of program, the kind of program you've set out would require. But I don't see any obstruction to looking at studying these universality classes with domain wall fermions, which would have the same symmetries in principle as the continuum model.
Maybe that's it for now, so we should have a little bit of a break before the next talk. So I suggest we reconvene in 10 minutes, let's say, more or less on the schedule. So thank you very much.